A freelance writer's career obliges him to accept, or more often solicit, assignments from as wide a range of periodicals as will help him pay his rent. This calls for a commensurate charivari of styles, column inches, and heights or depths of brow. One winter might find him reviewing an anthology of humorous prose for the New Yorker, subjecting his nether parts to the scrutiny of a Savile Row tailor at the whim of Forbes FYI, publishing an op-ed in the Washington Post in defense of a fellow scribe's libel case before the Supreme Court, and addressing a literary symposium at the Library of Congress. If the proceeds of all these, in the last case, a free lunch only, are measured against the current cost of living index, you can be sure that the same writer had to hack other work, advertising copy, appliance manuals, travel brochures, that he's now loath to remember, let alone reprint. Nevertheless, he cannot help feeling, as he flips through 40 years' worth of copy, that everything he wrote in the past sharpened his pen and amplified what Evelyn Waugh called a writer's capital, the raw material from which any mature style must derive. If he's lucky, as I was in my mid-30s, he'll have ended up in a genre conducive to book contracts. Thanks to the biographical appeal of Theodore Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, Ludwig van Beethoven, and my present subject, Thomas Edison, I no longer have to depend on the kindness of strange editors. The variety of disjecta membra collected here requires no apology. None were written just for money, and all were as good as I could make them. I've always believed that a professional writer should be able to produce on demand poems, pamphlets, screenplays, reviews, translations, monographs, bawdy lyrics, and whatever other commissions may challenge him. He must labor as hard on a sympathy letter as on an op-ed article or the opening page of a novel. It's common for essay collections to be arranged thematically, sometimes with a final miscellany, like the one in my old Collins Keats anthology, charmingly entitled Reflective, Occasional, and Humorous. I've chosen a chronological sequence in what amounts to a scrapbook of one man's literary life. If sequitur-minded listeners are disconcerted to hear an interview with Nadine Gordimer, followed by a profile of an obscure American painter, or an essay on punctuation sandwiched between a tribute to Ronald Reagan and a literary portrait of my wife, I hope that others may find the clash of subject matter agreeable, and possibly stimulating, should the roving eye encourage excursions back and forth. The initial essay from 1972 is the first piece I hope to see in print, a desire ungratified till 2012. The three that follow were written at various times but are grouped together for autobiographical background. All the rest, beginning with A Ghostly Tour with T.R., appear in order of composition. 4 didn't run for sundry reasons. The other 49 have been published or, in the case of lectures and broadcasts, given some sort of airing. Outside of literature in general, and biography in particular, my non-book work has consisted mainly of commentary on the presidency and writings about classical music. The last subject attracts me, not simply because I find regular absorption of intellectually ordered sounds as necessary as breathing, but because I enjoy the difficulty of trying to construe a superior language. A writer's duty is surely to reach, after Goethe, for das Unbeschreibliche, the abstract that resists verbal articulation, if only to strain one's abilities to the limit. Out of strain comes the strength to handle the task that words are best suited for, truth-telling, whether the factualness of non-fiction or the higher truths of poetry and novels. There is also here much of what I consider to be humor. All experience hath shown that what cracks this immigrant up doesn't necessarily amuse his compatriots. Most Americans, alas, suffer from a severe irony deficiency. Hence their neglect of Ambrose Bierce, this nation's supreme nihilist, and their hunger for political pieties. I suppose it's a consequence of the New World spirit of optimism, the willingness of the heart that Scott Fitzgerald rightly praised. The Old World's tendency to mock and disbelieve is not defensible, but I'm afraid that having to listen to the King's speech every Christmas when I was a boy infused me with a satiric sense that I cannot shake.